Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Jodi Prowse, and we're going to be talking about her memoir, The Sun Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, Addiction, and How I Broke Free. This is not a partial glimpse of addiction. It is the whole story. It begins with a violent childhood that bonded two children together forever, perhaps setting the stage for what was to come. Jodi's younger brother, Brett, became an alcoholic, and she, the sister of an alcoholic. As he walked the thin line between life and death, she experienced gut-wrenching highs and lows, obsessively doing what she could to get his life back on track, sacrificing her own young children, marriage, career, and personal health. Her love for him and his dependence on her would last them a lifetime and almost destroy them both. Like millions of people worldwide who love someone addicted to drugs or alcohol, Jodi believed that she was doing all the right things. Written with extreme candor, no shame, and in the hope of helping other families get help for themselves as well as their loved ones, The Sun Is Gone sheds a bright light on the often disturbing reality of the progression of alcoholism and what goes on behind closed doors. For more information, you can visit Jodi's website, which is www.jodiprowse.com, and that's JodieProwse.com. And I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Jodi to the show. Good day, Jodi.
Good day. Nice to be here with you, Robert. Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to have you here. This is a topic that we just can't talk enough about. You know, it just impacts so many people, and I doubt that there is one person listening who hasn't been touched by addiction, either drugs or alcohol. And your story is a great way for those who are touched by it to be able to get a candid look. So, first of all, I want to start with it's a memoir. Courageous of an author to do a memoir because you're putting yourself out there, you're putting yours or your family's baggage or you know all of that kind of thing out there. But it's there to help people. So, if you wouldn't mind, when did you decide that you were going to write this memoir, and did you have any reservations about doing that?
You know, it seemed like so long ago when I actually started or I thought I was going to do something. I've been surrounded by alcoholism my whole life. Like, it's in so many branches of our family tree. And when my younger brother became addicted, about 5 years into his addiction, it had become what I thought so completely insane that I never thought anyone could believe that alcohol could do this. Like I said, I saw it with other members of our family. It had always been around us. But this had just become the most severe addiction I'd ever seen. And so in 2005, I started taking notes about it, just as everything that was happening, I just started, you know, writing little notes. And so I wasn't serious about writing at that point. I just thought it was an important story. And then, of course, when I seriously sat down writing, which was 3 years ago, that certainly did help me go back and remember some of the exact details of what was happening.
Yeah. Did you find, as you were, you know, going back and reviewing what was written, I mean, was it cathartic in a way for you to go back and look at that in hindsight?
Well, yes, although I didn't know it at the time. My brother knew I was writing this story, and I had stopped for a while, and I had told him, you know, no one wants a lesson. They want an inspiration. And he said to me, you know, Jody, I promise I will be an inspiration. And so that gave me the strength to continue writing. I will say, however, he really did believe it was going to have a happy ending, which does show you, you know, the power of late-stage alcoholism, which is denial and delusion. And so when I really sat down seriously to start writing, I wouldn't be exaggerating when I said I cried in front of my laptop screen almost every day for 2 years. I caused pain still to my own husband. He had to, you know, witness that. His wife is hurting. But I just, first it was a promise fulfilled to my brother, and I just was so adamant that this is an important story to tell people.
Yeah, it is. So in the introduction, I indicated that it's raw, candid, unapologetic. So did you just kind of lay it out there? And did you have any reservations about doing that? Because, maybe was it just that people really needed to know exactly the extent that it could take?
I think it's all those things. I did, first, most memoirs are written, of course, too, by the addict in recovery. And so mine is a little bit different right off the bat in that it's a family member. But what I also did different is I started it from the very beginning. So to not only enlighten people that are in this world, but those that perhaps have had no experience, that just think it's a choice and they don't understand. So perhaps when you see innocent little children and some of these things that can happen to us to lead to addiction, that it will open your heart and challenge your mind. And I did, you know, out of all the memoirs I have written, mine would be right up there that had the most honest and disturbing events that take place. And I didn't do that for shock value. I did it because it is true. When you watch a loved one pass away from cancer, if you were to write all those details, they are uncomfortable, they are sad. And I look at my brother and the things that happen. They're symptoms as well. And I do wholeheartedly believe it's a disease. And, you know, when you ask me, did I have trouble putting all this down, you know, the one thing for me that has always been intact is I have absolutely no shame. And so it was actually very easy for me to sit and write an honest account.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You know, it's one of those things that I really think people need to see. You know, so often alcoholism is not spoken about in families. A lot of times it's just kind of, you know, pushed under the rug. People just deny it. Once it's really important to put it out there. Now, you know, it was interesting. In one of the chapters, you had taken Brett to the hospital, and the nurse wasn't really receptive to him, and can you explain that interaction? Because I think the nurse's reaction is what many people feel or do, then what your reaction was, because I think that is also, if not more important.
Yeah, well, in that particular scene, we were probably about halfway through our addiction journey, you know, I knew he was ashamed. He was an alcoholic. I knew he felt judged. I mean, he told me as much a lot of times. And when, and you do hear it in the media. In fact, the media makes fun of addiction quite often as well. But it is a disease. It's a disease by law. Science supports it's a disease. But the truth is, many times when we bring our loved ones to the hospital, it isn't treated as a disease. And so this little experience with the nurse, I mean, my brother was severely intoxicated, but he needed help coming down off of alcohol. You know, most people don't realize when you're addicted to that dramatically, you need help coming off. You can actually die from withdrawal. And this nurse was just so judgmental. It was like I witnessed it finally firsthand what my brother felt. Like, just she loathed him. She just, the look in her eyes. And, you know, most of the time I'm very calm and I, you know, try to just enlighten people with my story. But, no, I chased after the nurse down the hall. And when she turned around, I gave her a little blast and just, you know, reminded her that somebody loves that person. It's a human being. And, you know, she chose that profession. And then I said, you know, if you can't go in there and show someone some compassion, then if you can't do that tomorrow, I don't care. But for right now, you go in there and you fake it. And when she came back in, she was very kind to my brother. And, in fact, when we left, she it's still, when I talk about it, it'll bring a tear to my eye. I remember vividly, she said, take care of yourself, Brett. And, you know, I smiled at her. And I hope she knew how much I appreciated it. But more so, I hope I perhaps just reminded that nurse just to be a little bit more empathetic when she comes to work. And that's, I think, talking about these stories, I think ultimately that's what we hope to accomplish, just changing some perception and, you know.
Yeah. Raising awareness, changing perception, changing action. And, you know, and I'm sure the nurse probably to this day, you know, may catch herself, you know, if she should be in a position of where she should be a little bit more compassionate. I'm sure you would come to mind. But you know, in the book you mentioned, you know, the nurses have a difficult job. You know, they see all kinds of things, but it is really important to kind of pull away from to basically recognize the value of the individual with whom, you know, they're working with.
Yeah. And I'm the first to say, you know, we had so much help offered to us by all sorts of professionals. And, you know, I touched on the media judging and stigmatizing. But I also say, you know, I believe it starts in our own family. It's not just in the hospital and on television. And it's in our own family. We don't treat it like it's a disease. And you're absolutely right. We stay silent from the time we're little children. I mean, you don't tell us, but we hear you loud and clear. It just is something not to talk about. And we grow up feeling ashamed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, now, with this book, you self-published, but you didn't, you basically didn't have, you had a heck of a time finding a publisher who would pick it up. So, you know, why did you do that? And why do you think maybe there was such a lack of interest, you know, in the mainstream publishing world?
Well, I did, you know, I'm very persistent, and so I did send out about 300 emails. For people that don't know the process, I mean, I never thought it was going to be easy, or everyone, of course, would publish a book.
Right.
So you go after an agent, first, that's what you do, and then the agent sells it to the publishing house. So I sent out about 300, you know, emails to various agents. Now, most went unanswered. I never heard anything. But a lot did come back, not the topic for me. And I'm not going to try and speak for someone else on what that means. But I just couldn't really get anyone to even read it. And so I did go after, it's a kind of a faux pas in the industry, but I did go after a publisher directly. They read the book. They took it instantly. They agreed to publish it. And so we worked some more through, you know, editing and covers and things. And a few months before it was set to publish, they decided to change their format and they were not going to publish any more books. So you know what? I was about 60 days out. I have been through a lot in this life, and I do very much believe I have given up control of everything, of knowing what I can and can't control, right? And so it's like, okay, you know what? For some reason, this was made to happen. It's not going to stop me. It's ready for release. And so that's why I self-published.
That's good. Self-published, you know, and I've talked to literally hundreds and hundreds of authors over the last 6 years, and a good many had self-published, and I had heard some horror stories of going through, you know, typical publishers, our traditional publishers, and it was, you know, I got to the point where, you know, it was just important for me to just get the message out there, what I wanted to say, you know, and whomever was supposed to hear it, read it, would, and, you know, and it sounds like that's, you know, pretty much
I totally agree. I think it worked out for the best. And then actually what I ended up doing is, and it says it on the back of the book, I'm donating 50% of all my author profits to addiction and mental health programs. I'm very proud to be able to do that. And I wanted that to be on my brother's behalf, as well as everyone that buys it, that they can feel that they're part of bringing attention and making a difference. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I had a traditional publisher.
The amount would have certainly been significantly less.
A lot less. Very true. Very true.
Yeah. Well, now you said, you know, that, you know, this is unique in the sense that it's, you know, coming from, not from the addict or the alcoholic himself, it's coming from a family member. So, first of all, do you think that there is enough help and support for family members who have someone in their life who's addicted? I'm sure you went through all kinds of searches and actions to assist your brother. So what was that search like?
And I think you hit the nail on the head perfectly. I did, and my family did, and he had lots of support. But that's exactly what we were doing, is so support for my brother. What, you know, going to therapy and going to his sessions or learning. He would tell us what he learned. But that is, I think, the mistake that we made, is that we didn't get help for ourselves. You know, we're so convinced that we don't need help because we're not the one that's sick, we're not the one that's addicted. And what I know now is, no, we very much were helping play a part in this lifestyle. There was some unhealthy roles going on in our family. Part of the way through, people started shifting the blame. There was a tremendous amount of denial. There was codependency going on. There will be some families where this is not what's happening. I think for a lot of families, it is happening. And I think for everyone to be brave enough to all get help for yourself. You know, I thought I was doing all the right things. You know, like everyone, and you talk about, you know, I never gave my brother money. I never made excuses. I didn't call in sick for a grown man. And then years later, I just found out that I was enabling, that I was cleaning up his messes. And, you know, I thought that was support. And so you do need help with that line. And, you know, my biggest piece of advice is to stay aligned as a family and agree to disagree and listen to the advice of the professionals. I wish our family had done that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the important learning aspects from your book and from your journey for people who may do that. Now, again, they may not have the exact same, it may not manifest exactly the same as it was with you and your brother, but there is a core behavior with regard to addiction that, you know, that is I mean, it's just very basic, and it just manifests in, you know, so many different ways depending on the individual and the situation.
Yeah, exactly. And not only, you know, you could read 10 stories of addiction, and you could pull out their names and insert my brother's. I mean, absolutely, there's behaviors, it's a disease, right? There's progression.
Yeah.
But also with the family, I mean, we come from an alcoholic background, and so the doctors will tell you kind of what will happen to your family when you get older. We very much had me that became the caregiver. I was the oldest, and so all those, too, are things that you can learn throughout our story. And that is why I thought it was so important, because really, if you're anyone in our story, you do need to find the courage to change. It is not just my brother that this was happening to. And you know, maybe you're going to change on page 50 or page 75, or so that it doesn't progress to that level, and that there is hope for your family and your loved one.
Yeah, very much. Now, when you sat down to write your memoir and you were kind of going through the stuff that you had journaled, the write-ins that you had journaled, I have heard some authors indicate that they basically hear the voices or feel the presence of the individual of whom they're writing about. So did you have that experience with Brett?
Oh, I do, and I still do, you know, every day. Every chapter is a song title. And so my brother didn't like television, so every time, you know, I'd go to his house, there was always songs playing in the background, so like Kurt Cobain and Shannon Hoon and Steve Earle. And so those were all of his favorite songs. And so, one, that brought me back into the past as to what I was really feeling. But also, he and I were extremely close. I mean, before this really got a hold of him, he was my best friend. And so we shared cards and letters and emails and things all throughout this journey. So I had all those to go back with as well. So when I write, I very much put not only what I'm going through, but our dialogue and the things we would talk about and the things we would learn together. So his voice is very much in the story, although I will say, you know, near the end, his interpretation of what was happening was not reality.
But I do
play that out.
Yeah, there does tend to be some distorted thinking. I know of several people.
Yeah.
Now, in speaking of that, you went through great lengths to not indicate that your brother had died. And I know that, I mean, it's in your media kit that he did.
Yeah,
so I'm not giving it away.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, so why did you go to those lengths, you know, initially?
All we have as a family and for the one we love is hope. And if I really wanted to create a story where you are on the journey with us, a true journey, every step of the way, beginning, you know, like I said, I'm 5 years old, then
right.
I had to try and, okay, my brother is alive, and this is what we're learning, and this is what is happening.
Right.
And I really wanted the reader to perhaps change their view on what they believe about addiction and mental illness. And if you read the whole story and see them as a child and as a human being and as a brother or an uncle, right, or somebody's mom or whatever you envision, that you just will have a different view of it at the end. And so, you know, I do want to say he did lose his battle with alcoholism in March of 2012. But this book is still very much an inspiration and a happy ending to others. You can learn from our pages. And so that's where I think you should get strength so that this doesn't happen to you or your family.
Yeah, well, you know, and I can understand the telling the story kind of like in real time in a way, you know, when you're going through
exactly.
the experiences. Yeah, and, you know, and that makes sense. And in a way, it also, I would think, would raise the awareness in the reader that, you know, these things may be going on right now. You know, these things may be going on with my child or a child of a friend who I see or you know, someone who is a young adult, you know, and so they may be able to see some of that, you know, that real-time kind of experience playing out before them. So, and then the fact that when they get down to it, you know, that he did lose the battle, you know, that's the ultimate result that you really want to avoid. You know, if at all possible, you know, obviously the individual really kind of has to take control of themselves. But, you know, that's one of those things where you really want to avoid that happening, is because, you know, that's a human being with a resource that could be very valuable, you know, to people around them and to society.
Well, and I agree, and who wouldn't say, if their loved one was to pass away, who wouldn't say, oh my gosh, I wish I'd done things differently, or what if we had done this? And so I think that's ultimately what I'm trying to say. You know, we all do have different stories, but what remains the same for all of us is if our loved one is addicted to drugs or alcohol, they are told they will die if they don't get sober. And so use that really for your strengths. I mean, this is true. And people are dying every day. And so if our pages just gives other people the strength to change, you know, you're very right. The addict has to want to get well. But we are told there are definitely some things that you can be doing
right.
as a family that keep this going, like
exactly.
enabling.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
you know, for me, I followed my heart. Love is so powerful. It overpowers everything. You don't think straight, right?
It overpowers reason.
But,
yeah.
Doesn't it? And
yeah.
but if I could go back and just absolutely listen when, you know, don't do this. I trust in the professionals. I do trust they know what they're doing. And then, again, the addict still ultimately has to do the most work.
Exactly. Well, we're going to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners that if you would like to call in and ask Jody any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in, and we'll get to them right after the break. And it's just a real short break, Jody. But when we come back, I want to have you tell the listeners, did you get... Did you go to Al-Anon? And we talked a little bit about support. Did you go to Al-Anon? And what has been the reaction in the addiction community, you know, to what you've written? Okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there. Or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc. And we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide. books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Jodi Prowse, and we're talking about her newly released memoir, The Sun Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, Addiction, and How I Broke Free. Again, you can find out more about Jodi, her book, her blog, and many other things by visiting her website, which is www.jodiprowse.com, and that's JodieProuse.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Jodi.
Okay, great.
Okay, great. So, you know, you mentioned in the first half that, you know, getting support is really important. So did you, I'm thinking that you did not get support or seek out support from Al-Anon?
Well, it is what I say now should be the first thing that you do is seek out Al-Anon. But the truth is, you know, you started by saying, and
right.
It is so true. I'd been looking after my little brother since he was two. I thought that was my job, and it transitioned from a little girl into an adult. And I was obsessed with saving him. And so I would go to his therapist with him and a lot of times tell the story. I mean, I think back now, it seems so crazy, but, you know, I was his voice for so often, but, and, you know, take him to rehab and do all those things. I remember he told me once, Jodi, I think you've been to 100 appointments with me. I mean, a lot of those, too, were hospital stays and psychiatric wards and all sorts of things. I thought because I was, you know, at him with therapy and all this that I had a clear handle on what I was doing, and so I didn't need Al-Anon. And then, you know, all these years later, it's like, oh, my gosh, how could I have been so wrong? You know,
yeah.
Once again, just focused on the sick person instead of, okay, what do we also need to do? You know, we do. We send them to rehab. They're learning all these things. And
right.
What are we doing it, for lack of a better word? We're winging it, I think.
Right, yeah.
Right?
We're
also lost.
Yeah, and the impact that it has on your life is just astounding. I mean, when you think about all the time that you had to carve out, you know, to attend each of those meetings, each of those doctor's appointments, I mean, that was a significant portion of your life.
Yeah, it was for 6 years, and, you know, and I don't say it because I'm a hero. I say it because I was wrong. You know, sacrificing my job and my marriage and the well being of my own children. You know, my husband and I have a sober home, and we had made that decision over 20 years ago, just to do things different, right? Because it did come from our past, and I worked so hard at that. And then what I ended up doing and allowing my own kids to witness. Now, that doesn't mean I still wouldn't have been there to support my brother during his journey,
right. But
I would have set a healthy boundary long before and made him more accountable. You know, I on a lot of aspects, I took over, and I see that now.
Yeah. I have someone in my circle who is an enabler, and I just, you know, every now and then I won't, you know, come out and say it, but I kind of threw out there, well, you know, what if, you know, you looked at it this way, but it's, she feels like, you know, it gives her life purpose, that she's a martyr,
You know, and I just, you know, and it's like, we know living your life for someone else, trying to save someone else, isn't really living your life for you. I mean, you know, and it, to me, it's, I just find it, you know, I understand why she does it, you know, and I don't judge, I don't criticize, I just, you know, kind of allow it to happen, you know. I mean, that's what she wants to do.
Yeah.
But it's, but it can be hard to see, hard to witness, and especially in someone that you love.
And it's hard, one, and it's hard to stop. It is very hard to stop. And again, I don't say it, and doctors don't say it to be judgmental either. You are literally helping someone to potentially die. You know, we do all hear so many times, someone just said it to me about a week ago when they bought my book. You know, we don't enable, we don't do anything like that, but we just have decided that we will never let them be homeless. And, you know, I don't have the answers. I'm the one that tells the story,
yeah.
And if you can relate to any of these things, to go and get help and listen to those people. But, you know, all I can say is I would give anything if my brother was homeless.
Yeah, yeah. Alive and homeless, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that, you know, you kind of mentioned about, you know, how we kind of allow, in your marketing materials, one of the things you indicate is that you feel that you helped your brother kill himself. Now, I don't know if you still feel that way, but, you know, what would you say to people out there who have had similar situations who maybe feel that way right now?
Well, one, I want to clarify that statement by saying I do not on any level think I'm responsible for my brother's death, nor should anyone else. When I say I helped my brother kill himself, you know, it seems so shocking when I say it, or when a sister says it, but it is exactly what the doctors say to you, or the therapists and the counselors. If you enable and you continue doing these things for them so that they, you know, do not have any reason to change, you will help them die. I mean, we're told that. And so that's kind of where that statement comes from. But, you know, with everybody, you should, no one, not the addict, not the family member, we are all human and we all make mistakes and we all learn as we go through this thing called life. And so no one should ever feel responsible or blame or any of those things. I think wherever you are, I think people should be very proud to learn from their lessons and to admit that they have done things that they regret, you know, and say sorry. And, you know, I say now, you know, accept and learn and forgive and then heal.
Yeah, very, very good. Every single one of those is real important. So now, one of the things, you know, we mentioned early on is that it was your family that was alcoholic. So as children, you witnessed, you lived in an alcoholic environment?
Yeah, we, with our father, and I will say, you know, my mother and my mom and dad got divorced when I was 9, and so my brother was 5, and our younger sister was, you know, 1 or 2, I think. And they're just the fighting and the violence and having to flee the house, you know, in the middle of the night. And those are memories that I have of having to, you know, get my brother, you know, get his little coat on. And I remember how scared he was and the crying and things like that. And then, you know, our grandfather, our uncle was severely addicted, and you know, his brothers and sisters, I don't think he left the confines of his trailer for 20 or 25 years. So,
wow.
You know, piles of beer bottles and the filth, and they'd actually, you know, have to force him to shower and bring some clothes just to, you know, for him
yeah.
to come to Christmas dinner. And those things stay with you as a child. And, you know, someone said to me, geez, you saw all that stuff, and yet your brother became an alcoholic. Didn't he learn?
Right.
And, you know, there is a reason, I believe, why this just continues a lot of times, generation after generation. These become our normal. These become our lessons. A lot of them are our lessons of right, not our lessons of wrong. It is what we see, and nobody's explaining to us that uncle is sick or that this is what is going on with grandpa. And so we're not really getting the correct message, I think, as we grow into an adult.
Yeah. Well, you know, you indicate that it's a family disease. And one of the things that, you know, strikes me about, you know, the situation, I mean, and I've been surrounded by it too. So, I mean, I, you know firsthand
yeah.
the behaviors. One of the things that just strikes me is that, you know, family, I'm of the belief that family is kind of a structure that was created way back when to teach unconditional love, to just,
yeah.
you know, that a family is predisposed to love you, no matter who you are, no matter
yeah.
what you do, you know, that's your family. Now, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, to me that is, you know, to me that is what I think family is about. And it seems that, you know, in cases like, you know, addiction, that, you know, it's just so important to bring the family in, to be able to help teach loving relationships, to help, you know, gain an awareness and understanding, to, you know, and for children to be able to educate them so that they choose a different path. Anyway, to me, that, you know, when I read about, you know, you saying that it's a family disease, that's the kind of thing that just popped into my head.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, my one of my biggest messages is encouraging to talk to young children. I just wrote a blog about it about 2 weeks ago, because when Ben Affleck came out and said he went to treatment for alcoholism, it wasn't that was as surprising to me as when he said that he wants this to be a lesson to his children. And
yeah.
it inspired me to do a blog, because it's like, you told your children, and it just brought a smile to my face, because I was
yeah.
that child. And
yeah.
and to raise them to know that daddy isn't perfect, that daddy is ill, that I am sure forgiveness for some things and an explanation and all that. And kids are so resilient. I mean, they love their parents so much.
Yeah.
I just think it's a beautiful gift. And I believe that's where we will really, truly see change in the future, is raising these little people to know that addiction and mental illness is a disease.
Exactly. And the little ones we have coming up are just amazing. You know, I think it's great. You know, I'm constantly amazed at some of the love and compassion from some of these kids who are, you know, 8 and 9 years old. And it's like, wow, you know, this is an example. This is the way, you know, this is our future. So
it is. And people are talking about it now. And so they will be comfortable. So it is. It's very nice to be a part of a changing world, that's for sure.
I agree. So now I kind of want to bring up, kind of do and kind of don't, the healthcare system the challenges that people with addictions face, you know, when trying to navigate, you know, the healthcare system. And then,
yeah.
you know, the fact that it seems like, you know, whenever I see some stories about, well, like I just saw, you know, the budget proposal, you know, that came out, and it was like, you know, SNAP, you know, for children programs being reduced, you know, disabilities are being reduced. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just not right. So, what's been your experience with working with the healthcare system with Brett, and what are your feelings about maybe where we should go with that?
Yeah. Well, I don't think there is going to be any easy answer except everybody rallying together with a voice and saying, you know, with all the education we have, addiction is on the rise. I mean, this is something to be very, very concerned about. And it just doesn't add up for me when we say it's a disease and yet there's programs that aren't paid for and like we've just talked about, we go to a hospital and we're sent on our way, even though someone can die from withdrawal. So, you know, my experience with my brother, I mean, I had some good and bad experiences in the hospital. We are from Canada, so I will say every time we go to the hospital, it is free. Now, having said that, a lot of times there was no beds, and so he had to leave. But our detox, where he would, you know, you would go to a medical detox for 4 or 5 days, all of that is free. All of that is covered. And what isn't covered is, you know, therapy and counseling and things like that. And you know, I think at the end it was about $125 an hour. But the wonderful thing about counseling and things, not everybody can afford that, but there's wonderful books that people can also buy. So I would that definitely helped me, and I know it helped him at the time. Our rehab centers, I think he went twice where it was covered or there was a very small little fee, and he did go twice where it was, you know, $5,000 for 30 days, and he went twice where it was $25,000.
Wow.
So,
wow.
It you know, I feel for people that cannot afford that. And all I can say is we have to just keep talking and really make sure there's as much, you know, focus placed on that as there is, let's say, with cancer.
Yeah.
Because there is people that cannot afford those fees.
I agree. Now, you know, you mentioned Ben Affleck and his declaration, you know, and to his children as a good example. And since you're in Canada, Jimmy Fallon also made fun of Rob Ford and his alcoholism. So, you know, it's, do you feel that media should, or that it would be better for educating and raising awareness if the media didn't play into the, you know, making a light of the disease?
Well, you know, you talk about all of us, you know, like that, rolling back to that judgmental nurse and maybe she...
Right.
Every once in a while remembers that she met me and just kind of stands back and goes, oh, you know, to kind of give yourself a little reminder of who you are. And Jimmy Fallon is not a bad person. But if you could to say to him, I remember watching that, you know, Rob Ford has since passed away, and I remember watching that, and would that be okay? Would an audience be laughing? Would people at home be laughing? Would he? What would happen if he was up there making fun of somebody dying of Alzheimer's? Can you imagine how attacked he would be? But it does just show you on a grand level the difference in how you know you're treated. You know, and we need to stop doing those things. You know, Ricky Lake's ex-husband just passed away from suicide, and I knew right away when she, and I knew exactly what she meant when she posted, you know, my beloved ex-husband lost his battle with bipolar disease, and that's all she wrote. And right, you know, I totally knew what she meant, and right away people start, no one dies from bipolar, and, you know, why would you be divorced if he was your soulmate and things like that. And, you know, no, we lose sight of the things because of how the media represents it. People aren't really dying of suicide. we're losing sight that people are dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and bipolar and schizophrenia and depression, and that is going to lead to suicide. And, you know, why can someone be divorced from their soulmate? Because this is a hard, hard journey.
Yeah.
And relationships, the hard journey, even, for, you know, I feel and I send hugs and loves to anyone that's going through it, because relationships, my brother didn't survive, and relationships also don't survive this journey. So,
yeah.
It is
very hard. Now, in the title of your book, it ends with "How I Broke Free." So, for people out there listening who are struggling with this, what would be your words of advice to them to help them break free?
Yeah, when I finished my story, it was 2.5 years of writing, and at the time the person that was going to publish it, I thought it was over. This is it. This is the end. And they said, no, you have to have at the end like an inspiration and where are you at? And I struggled. And so I faced my fears and I went on an airplane and I went by myself to a little island out in Victoria for the weekend to write my ending. And I cried and cried for 3 days and everything's fresh in my mind. And my breaking free, so, you know, 4 years after my brother passed away, when I really understand now, I thought he was my responsibility.
Right.
And I think, you know, not everyone will feel that. But
right.
On some level, you just are so determined to help the one you love that I think you lose yourself. And it is okay to look after yourself.
I think it's critical. You know.
It is. You're no help to anyone else if you're not healthy yourself. I mean, at the end of the day, the only person we have real control over is us.
Yep.
Who we are. Yeah, and it's, you know, I feel so many emotions. I mean, now I'm so proud and happy, and I feel blessed I was his sister. And I will tell you, the one emotion I do not carry is that one of guilt. I know I did everything for him, for him,
right.
And I did the best I could with the knowledge
right.
I had at the time. I just hope, like now, you know, I educate myself, and I hope to share some of this other knowledge with other people. So,
yeah. So that is that. Obviously, that's really what you want the reader to get from reading the book is hope and possibility.
Hope, absolutely. Never ever lose hope. There will be people out there that are on, you know, the same level that we were, and it's hard to get out of bed every day. But hope is what gets us there. Don't ever, ever lose hope. And even for the ones that have lost someone they love, it's just to maybe find their voice to turn it into a positive for someone else. You know, if we don't speak, more and more you're hearing from families. I mean, certainly we're not the norm. I mean, you're definitely hearing from people in recovery, but the families need to have a voice as well, and for anyone that's lost someone to find the courage and be proud of that loved one, not ashamed, because you can help someone else.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of hope, that just reminded me of that proverb that hope springs eternal. It's in the human beast, and, you know, that's just the one thing that that we can create in ourselves and create in others around me. You know, I like inspiration. That's my thing. You know, to create that and to try and be that as much as I can. But hope is right up there. You know, with sharing stories like yours.
Well, and I know, and I had said, you know, my brother, I remember, it was, I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and he was sober, and we went for a walk, and that's when he said, I promise I'll be an inspiration. And, you know, I ended my book that way. And I said, you know, maybe it was him that was right all along, and just not in the way he meant it. But I hope our story inspires you all to get the help you need and find the courage to change.
Absolutely.
No matter how,
yeah. Go ahead. No matter
how far down the gravelly road you have traveled, it is never too late to turn around.
Exactly. Well, I really want to thank you for your time today. It's just really been a pleasure hearing your story and the advice that you had for the listeners. So I really want to thank you for your time.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Jody Prowse. We've been talking about her new memoir, The Sun Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, Addiction, and How I Broke Free. Again, you can find out more about the book and her blog by visiting the website, www.jodyprowse.com. And that's JodeeProuse.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again,